After Witbank, the road narrowed. There was heavy traffic and the bends had dangerous camber and deceptive gradients. David was able to concentrate on keeping the big car on the road and to drive the phantoms from his mind. He took the Leidenberg turnoff, cutting the corner of the triangle, and the traffic thinned out to an occasional truck. He was able to go flat out again and race along the edge of the high escarpment. Then suddenly the road turned and began its plunge down into the Lohfeldt. When he emerged from the Erasmus Tunnel, David ran into the rain. It was a solid grey bank of water that filled the air and buffeted the body of the Pontiac. It flooded the road, so David had difficulty following its verge beneath the standing sheets of water, and it swamped the windshield so that the efforts of the wipers to clear it were defeated. David switched on his headlights and drove as fast as he dared, craning forward in his seat to peer into the impenetrable blue-grey curtains of rain. Darkness came early in the rain, beneath the lowering black clouds, and the wet road dazzled him with the reflections of his own headlights, while the fat falling drops seemed as big as hailstones. He was forced to moderate his speed a little more, creeping down the highway towards Bandelier Hill. In the darkness, he almost missed the turning, and he reversed back to it, swinging onto the unmade surface. It was slushy with mud, puddled and swampy, slippery as grease. Again, he was forced to lower his speed. Once, he lost it and slid broadside into the drainage ditch. By packing loose stones under the wheels and racing the engine, he pulled the Pontiac out and drove on. By the time he reached the bridge over the Luzzani stream, he had been 6 hours at the wheel of the Pontiac, and it was a few minutes after 8 o'clock in the evening. As he reached the bridge, the rain stopped abruptly, a freak hole in the weather. Directly overhead, the stars showed mistily, while around them the cloud banks swirled, turning slowly, as though upon the axis of a great wheel. David's headlights cut through the darkness, out across the mad brown waters to the far bank 100 yards away. The bridge was submerged under 15 feet of flood water, and the water was moving so swiftly that its waves and whirlpools seemed sculptured in polished brown marble, and the trunks of uprooted trees dashed downstream upon the flood. It seemed impossible that the bed of this raging torrent had been the narrow sandy bed in which Johann Uckers had run down Conrad with the green Ford truck. David climbed out of the Pontiac and walked down to the edge of the water. As he stood there, he saw the level creeping up perceptibly towards his feet. It was still rising. He looked up at the sky and judged that the respite in the weather would not last much longer. He reached his decision and ran back to the Pontiac. He reversed well back onto the highest ground and parked it off the verge with the headlights still directed at the river edge. Then, standing beside the door, he stripped down to his shirt and underpants. He pulled his belt from the loops of his trousers and buckled it about his waist. Then he tied his shoes to the belt by their laces. Barefooted, he ran to the edge of the water and began to feel his way slowly down the bank. It shelved quickly, and within a few paces he was knee-deep and the current plucked at him, viciously trying to drag him off balance. He poised like that, braced against the current, and waited, staring upstream. He saw the tree trunk coming down fast on the flood, with its roots sticking up like beseeching arms. It was swinging across the current and would pass him closely. He judged his moment and lunged for it. Half a dozen strong strokes carried him to it, and he grasped one of the roots. Instantly, he was whisked out of the beams of the headlight into the roaring fury of the river. The tree rolled and bucked, carrying him under and bringing him up coughing and gasping. Something struck him a glancing blow, and he felt his shirt tear and the skin beneath it rip. Then he was underwater again, swirling end over end and clinging desperately to his log. All about him, the darkness was filled with the rush and threat of crazy water, and he was buffeted and flogged by its raw strength, grazed and bruised by rocks and driftwood. Suddenly, he felt the log check and bump against an obstruction, turning and swinging out into the current again. David was blinded with muddy water, and he knew there was a limit to how much more of this treatment he could survive. Already he was weakening quickly. He could feel his mind and his movements slowing, like a battered prize fighter in the 10th round. He gambled it all on the obstruction which the log had encountered, being the far bank, and he released his death grip on the root and struck out sideways across the current with desperate strength. His overarm stroke ended in the trailing branches of a thorn tree hanging over the storm waters. Thorns tore the flesh of his palm as his grip closed over them, and he cried out at the pain, but held on. Slowly he dragged himself out of the flood and crawled up the bank, hacking and coughing at the water in his lungs. Clear of the river, he fell on his face in the mud and vomited a gush of swallowed water that shot out of his nose and mouth. He lay exhausted for a long while, until his coughing slowed and he could breathe again. His shoes had been torn from his belt by the current. He dragged himself to his feet and staggered forward into the darkness. As he ran, he held his hand to his face, pulling the broken thorns from the flesh of his palm with his teeth. Stars were still showing overhead, and by their feeble light he made out the road, and he began to run along it, gathering strength with each pace. It was very still now, with only the dripping of the trees and the occasional far-off mutter of thunder to break the silence. 2 miles from the homestead, David made out the dark bulk of something on the side of the road, and it was only when he was a few paces from it that he realized it was an automobile, a late-model Chevy. It had been abandoned, bogged down in one of the greasy mud holes that the rains had opened. The doors were unlocked, and David switched on the interior and parking lights. There was dried blood on the seat, a dark smear of it, and on the back seat was a bundle of clothing. David untied it quickly and recognized immediately the coarse canvas suiting as regulation prison garb. He stared at it stupidly for a moment until the impact of it struck him. The car was stolen. The blood probably belonged to the unfortunate owner. The prison garb had been exchanged for other clothing, probably taken from the body of the owner of the Chevy. David knew then, beyond all possible doubt, that Johann Akers was at Jabulani, and that he had arrived before the bridge over the Lutsani stream had become impassable, probably 3 or 4 hours previously. David threw the prison suiting back into the car, and he began to run. Johann Akers drove the Chevy across the Lutsani bridge with the rising waters swirling over the guardrail and with the rain teeming down in blinding white sheets. The muddy water shoved at the body of the car, making steering difficult, and it seeped in under the doors, flooding the floorboards and swirling about Akka's feet. But he reached the safety of the far bank and raced the engine as he shot up it. The wheels spun on the soft mud, and the Chevy skidded and swayed drunkenly in the loose footing. The closer he drew to Jabulani, the more reckless he became in his haste. Before his conviction and imprisonment, Akka's had been a twisted and blighted creature, a man of deep moods and passionate temper. Feeling himself rejected and spurned by his fellow men, he had lived in a world of swift defensive violence, but always he had kept within the bounds of reason. However, during the 2 years that he had labored and languished within prison walls, his anger and his lust for vengeance had driven him over that narrow boundary. Vengeance had become the sole reason for his existence, and he had rehearsed it 100 times each day. He had planned his prison break to give himself 3 days of freedom. After that, it did not matter. 3 days would be enough. He had infected his own jaw, running a needle poisoned with his excreta deeply into the gum. They had taken him to the dental clinic, as he had planned. The guard had been easily handled, and the dentist had cooperated with a scalpel held to his throat. Once clear of the prison, Akers had used the scalpel, vaguely surprised by the volume of blood that could issue from a human throat. He had left the dentist slumped over his steering wheel on a plot of waste ground, and with his white laboratory gown over his prison suit, he had waited at a set of traffic lights. The shiny new Chevy had pulled up for a red light, and Akers had opened the passenger door and slid in beside the driver. He had been a smaller man than Akers, plump and prosperous-looking, with a smooth, pale face and soft little hairless hands on the steering wheel. He had obeyed meekly Akers' instruction to drive on. Akers had rolled his soft white body, clad only in vest and shorts, into a clump of thick grass beside a disused secondary road, and pulled the grass closed over him. Then he had beaten the first roadblock out of the city area by 40 minutes. He stayed on the side roads, picking his way slowly eastwards. The infection in his jaw had ached intolerably despite the shot of antibiotics the dentist had given him, and his crippled claw of a hand had been awkward and clumsy on the gear lever, for the severed nerves and sinews had never knitted again. The hand was a dead and insensate thing. Using the caution of a natural predator, and helped by the news flashes on the radio, he had groped his way carefully through the net that was spread for him, and now he was on Jabalani, and he could restrain himself no longer. He hit the mud hole at 40, and the Chevy whipped and spun, slewing her back end deep into the mud and high-centering her belly on the soft ooze. He left her there and went on swiftly through the rain, loping on long legs. Once he giggled and sucked at his teeth, but then he was silent again. It was dark by the time he climbed the koppie behind Jabalani homestead. He lay there for 2 hours, peering down into the driving rain, waiting for the darkness. Once night fell, he could see no lights, and he began to worry. There should have been lights burning. He left the koppie and moved cautiously through the darkness down the hill. He avoided the servants' quarters and went through the trees to the landing strip. He ran into the side of the hangar in the dark and followed the wall to the side doorway. Frantically, he spread his arms and felt for the aircraft that should be there. And when he realized that it was not, he let out a groan of frustration. They were gone. He had planned and schemed in vain. All his desperate striving was in vain. Growling like an animal, he smashed the fist of his good hand against the wall, enjoying the pain of it in his frustration. And his anger and his hatred was so strong that it shook his body like a fever, and he cried out aloud, a formless animal cry without coherence or sense. Suddenly the rain stopped. The heavy drum of it upon the iron roof of the hangar ceased so abruptly that Akers was distracted. He went to the opening and looked out. The stars were swimming mistily above him, and the only sound was the gurgle and chuckle of running water and the dripping of the trees. There was the glimmering of light now, and he saw the white walls of the homestead shine amongst the trees. He could do damage there, Akers realized. He could find there some outlet for his terrible frustration. There was furniture to smash, and the thatch would burn. If lit from inside, the thatch would burn even in this weather. He started towards the homestead through the dark, sodden trees. Deborah woke in the silence. She had fallen asleep in the midst of the storm, perhaps as a form of escape. Now she groped for the warm, comforting body of the dog, but he was gone. There was a patch of warmth on the bed beside her where he had lain. She listened intently, and there was nothing but the soft sounds of water in the guttering and far off the growl of thunder. She remembered her earlier panic, and she was ashamed. She stood up from the bed, and she was shivering with the cold, in her loose, free-flowing dark blue maternity blouse and the elastic-fronted slacks that were adjustable to her expanding waistline. She felt with her toes and found the light ballet pumps on the stone floor and pushed her feet into them. She started towards her dressing room for a sweater. Then she would make herself a cup of hot soup, she decided. Zulu started barking. He was outside in the front garden. Clearly, he had left the house through the small hinged doorway that David had built especially for him in the veranda wall. The dog had many barks, each with a different meaning which Deborah understood. A self-effacing woof that was the equivalent of the watchman's 10 o'clock on a June night and all's well. Or a longer, drawn-out yowl that meant, there is a full moon out tonight and the wolf's blood in my veins will not allow me to sleep. A sharper, meaningful bark, something is moving down near the pump house, it may be a lion. And then there was an urgent, clamoring chorus. There is dire danger threatening, beware, beware. It was the danger bark now. and then growling through closed jaws as though he were worrying something. Deborah went out onto the veranda, and she felt the puddled rainwater soaking through her light shoes. Zulu was harrying something in the front garden. She could hear the growling and scuffling, the movement of bodies locked in a struggle. She stood silently, uncertain of what to do, knowing only that she could not go out to Zulu. She was blind and helpless against the unknown adversary. As she hesitated, she heard clearly the sound of a heavy blow. It cracked on bone, and she heard the thump of a body falling. Zulu's growls were cut off abruptly, and there was silence. Something had happened to the dog. Now she was completely alone in the silence. No, not silence. There was the sound of breathing, a heavy, panting breath. Deborah shrank back against the veranda wall, listening and waiting. She heard footsteps, human footsteps, coming through the garden towards the front door. The footsteps squelched and splashed in the rain puddles. She wanted to call out a challenge, but her voice was locked in her constricted throat. She wanted to run, but her legs were paralyzed by the sound of the intruder climbing the front steps. A hand brushed against the wire screening and then settled on the handle, rattling it softly. At last, Deborah found her voice. Who's that? She called, a high, panicky cry that ran out into the night silence. Instantly, the soft sounds ceased. The intruder was frozen by her challenge. She could imagine whoever it was standing on the top step, peering through the screening into the darkness of the veranda, trying to make her out in the gloom. Suddenly, she was thankful for the dark blouse and black slacks. She waited motionlessly, listening, and she heard a little wind shake the treetops, bringing down a sudden, quick patter of droplets. A hunting owl called down near the dam. She heard the thunder murmur bad-temperedly along the hills, and a nightjar screeched harshly from amongst the poinsettia bushes. Silence went on for a long time, and she knew she could not stand it much longer. She could feel her lips beginning to quiver, and the cold and fear and the weight of the child were heavy upon her bladder. She wanted to run, but there was nowhere to run to. Then suddenly the silence was broken. In the darkness there was the sound of a man giggling. It was shockingly close and clear, and it was a crazy sound. The shock of it seemed to clutch at her heart and crush the air from her lungs. Her legs went weak under her, beginning to shake, and the pressure on her bladder was intolerable. For she recognized the sound of that laughter. The sick, insane sound of it was graven upon her mind. A hand shook the door handle, jerking and straining at it. Then a shoulder crashed into the narrow frame. It was a screen door, not built to withstand rough treatment. Deborah knew it would yield quickly. She screamed then, a high, ringing scream of terror, and it seemed to break the spell which held her. Her legs would move again and her brain would work. She whirled and ran back into her workroom, slamming the door and locking it swiftly. She crouched beside the door, thinking desperately. She knew that as soon as he broke into the house, Akers need only switch on a light. The electricity generator would automatically kick in on demand, and in the light, he would have her at his mercy. Her only protection was darkness. In the darkness, she would have the advantage, for she was accustomed to it. She had heard the nightjar and the owl calling, so she knew that night had fallen, and it was probable that the rain clouds still blanketed moon and stars. Darkness was out there in the forest. She must get out of the house and try to reach the servants' quarters. She hurried through the rooms towards the rear of the house, and as she went, she thought of a weapon. The firearms were locked in the steel cabinet in David's office, and the key was with him. She ran through to the kitchen, and her heavy walking stick was in its place by the door. She grasped it thankfully and slipped open the door catch. At that moment, she heard the front door crash open, with the lock kicked in, and she heard Akers charge heavily into the living room. She closed the kitchen door behind her and started across the yard. She tried not to run. She counted her steps. She must not lose her way. She must find the track around the kopje to the servants' hutments. Her first landmark was the gate in the fence that ringed the homestead. Before she reached it, she heard the electricity generator throb to life in the powerhouse beyond the garages. Akers had found a light switch. She was slightly off in her direction, and she ran into the barbed wire fence. Frantically, she began to feel her way along it, trying for the gate. Above her head, she heard the buzz and crackle of the element in one of the arc lamps that lined the fence, and could flood the gardens with light. Akers must have found the switch beside the kitchen door, and Deborah realized that she must be bathed in the light of the arcs. She heard him shout behind her, and knew that he had seen her. At that moment, she found the gate, and with a sob of relief, she tore it open and began to run. She must get out of the light of the arcs. She must find the darkness. Light was mortal danger. Darkness was sanctuary. The track forked, left to the pools, right to the hutments. She took the right-hand path and ran along it. Behind her, she heard the gate clank shut. He was after her. She counted as she ran, 500 paces to the rock on the left side of the path that marked the next fork. She tripped over it, falling heavily and barking her shins. She rolled to her knees, and she had lost the walking stick. She could not waste precious seconds in searching for it. She groped for the path and ran on. 50 paces, and she knew she was on the wrong fork. This path led down to the pump house, and she was not familiar with it. It was not one of her regular routes. She missed a turn and ran into broken ground. She stumbled on until rank grass wrapped about her ankles and brought her down again, falling heavily on her side so that she was winded. She was completely lost, but she knew she was out of the arc lights now. With luck, she was shielded by complete darkness, but her heart was racing and she felt nauseous with terror. She tried to control her gulping, sobbing breath and to listen. She heard him coming then, pounding footsteps that rang clearly, even on the rain-soaked earth. He seemed to be coming directly to where she lay, and she shrank down against the wet earth, and she pressed her face into her arms to hide her face and muffle her breathing. At the last moment, his blundering footsteps passed her closely and ran on. She felt sick with relief, but it was premature, for abruptly the footsteps ceased, and he was so close she could hear him panting. He was listening for her, standing close beside where she lay in the grass. They stayed like that during the long, slow passage of minutes. For Deborah, it seemed an eternity of waiting, broken at last by his voice.
"Aha! There you are," he giggled. "There you are. I can see you."
Her heart jumped with shock. He was closer than she had thought. Almost, she jumped up and began to run again, but some deeper sense restrained her.
"I can see you hiding there," he repeated,
giggling and snickering.
"I've got a big knife here. I'm going to hold you down and cut."
She quailed in the grass, listening to the awful obscenities that poured from his mouth. Then suddenly she realized that she was safe here. She was covered by the night and the thick grass, and he had lost her. He was trying to panic her, make her run again, and betray her position. She concentrated all her attention on remaining absolutely still and silent. Akers' threats and sadistic droolings ended in silence again. He listened for her with the patience of the hunter, and the long minutes dragged by. The ache in her bladder was like a red-hot iron, and she wanted to sob out loud. Something loathsome crawled out of the wet grass over her arm. Her skin prickled with fresh horror at the feel of multiple insect feet on her skin, but she steeled herself not to move. The thing, scorpion or spider, crawled across her neck, and she knew her nerves would crack within seconds. Suddenly, Akka spoke again.
"All right," he said. "I'm going back to fetch a flashlight. We'll see how far you get then. I'll be back soon. Don't think you'll beat old Akers. He's forgotten more tricks than you'll ever learn."
He moved away heavily, noisily, and she wanted to strike the insect from her cheek and run again, but some instinct warned her. She waited 5 minutes, and then 10. The insect moved up into her hair. Akers spoke again out of the darkness near her.
"You're right, you clever bitch. We'll get you yet."
And she heard him move away. This time she knew he had gone. She brushed the insect from her hair, shuddering with horror. Then she stood up and moved quietly into the forest. Her fingers were stiff and cold on the fastenings of her slacks, but she loosened them and squatted to relieve the burning ache in her lower belly. She stood up again and felt the child move within her body. The feel of it evoked all her maternal instincts of protection. She must find a safe place for her child. She thought of the hide by the pools. How to reach them? For she was now completely lost. Then she remembered David telling her about the wind, the rain wind out of the west, now reduced to an occasional light air, and she waited for the next breath of it on her cheek. It gave her direction. She turned her back to the next gust and set off steadily through the forest with hands held out ahead to prevent herself running into one of the trunks. If only she could reach the pools, she could follow the bank to the hide. As the cyclonic winds at the center of the storm turned upon their axis, so they swung, changing direction constantly, and Deborah followed them faithfully, beginning a wide, aimless circle through the forest. Ukkas raged through the brightly lit homestead of Jabulani, jerking open drawers and kicking in locked cupboard doors. He found the gun cabinet in David's office and ransacked the desk drawers for keys. He found none, and giggled and swore with frustration. He crossed the room to the built-in cupboard unit. There was a sealed cell electric lantern on the shelf with a dozen packets of shotgun shells. He took down the lantern eagerly and thumbed the switch. The beam was bright white, even in the overhead lights, and he sucked his teeth and chuckled happily. Once more he ran into the kitchen, pausing to select a long stainless steel carving knife from the cutlery drawer before hurrying across the yard to the gate and along the path. In the lantern beam, Deborah's footprints showed clearly in the soft earth, with his own overlaying them. He followed them to where she had blundered off the path and found the mark of her body where she had lain. "Clever bitch," he chuckled again, and followed her tracks through the forest. She had laid an easy trail to follow, dragging a passage through the rain-heavy grass and wiping the droplets from the stems. To the hunter's eye, it was a clearly blazed trail. Every few minutes he paused to throw the beam of the lantern ahead of him amongst the trees. He was thrilling now to the hunter's lust, the primeval force which was the mainspring of his existence. His earlier setback made the chase sweeter for him. He went on carefully, following the wandering trail, the aimless footprints turning haphazardly in a wide circle. He stopped again and panned the lantern beam across the rain-laden grass tops, and he saw something move at the extreme range of the lamp, something pale and round. He held it in the lantern beam and saw the woman's pale, strained face as she moved forward slowly and hesitantly. She went like a sleepwalker, with arms extended ahead of her and with shuffling, uncertain gait. She was coming directly towards him, oblivious of the light which held her captive in its beam. Once she paused to hug her swollen belly and sob with weariness and fear. The legs of her trousers were sodden with rainwater, and her flimsy shoes were already torn. And as she hobbled closer, he saw that her arms and her lips were blue and shivering with the cold. Ukkas stood quietly watching her coming towards him, like a chicken drawn to the swaying cobra. Her long, dark hair hung in damp ropes down her shoulders and dangled in her face. Her thin blouse was wet also with drops fallen from the trees, and it was plastered over the thrusting mound of her belly. He let her come closer, enjoying the fierce thrill of having her in his power, drawing out the final consummation of his vengeance, hoarding each moment of it like a miser. When she was 5 paces from him, he played the beam full in her face, and he giggled. She screamed, her whole face convulsing, and she whirled like a wild animal and ran blindly, 20 flying paces before she ran headlong into the stem of a marula tree. She fell back, collapsing to her knees and sobbed aloud, clutching at her bruised cheek. Then she scrambled to her feet and stood shivering, turning her head and cocking it for the next sound. Silently he moved around her, drawing close, and he giggled again, close behind her. She screamed again, and ran blindly, panic-stricken, witless with terror, until an ant-bear hole caught her foot and flung her down heavily to the ground, and she lay there sobbing. Uckers moved leisurely and silently after her. He was enjoying himself for the first time in 2 years. Like a cat, he did not want to end it. He wanted it to last a long time. He stooped over her and whispered a filthy word, and instantly she rolled to her feet and was up and running again, wildly, sightlessly through the trees. He followed her, and in his crazed mind she became a symbol of all the thousand animals he had hunted and killed.